I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And I strongly suspect that very few, if any, of you need to know who that is. That's, of course, the Beatles and the title track of their groundbreaking album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. The reason you are hearing a few measures of that iconic Beatles song at the top of today's morning show is because the next concert of the Choral Arts Society of Southeastern Wisconsin is going to be devoted to the music of the Beatles. And in part one of today's morning show, we're going to be talking about that concert and about the Beatles with three gentlemen who are part of this weekend's concert, Saturday night out at Racine's Airport. First of all, Jim Schatzman, of course, the artistic director of the Choral Arts Society, and with him, two of the guest musicians who are going to be rocking the house Saturday night. Mark Paffrath has been on the morning show before, although it's been way too long. Mark, it's good to see you again.
Good to see you, Greg.
And Marvin Dykhouse, whom I am meeting for the very first time, who is also going to be lending his musical talents to Saturday night's concert. We welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Very nice to meet you.
And Jim Schatzman, of course, welcome back to the morning show. Tell us a little bit about how this kind of a concert, which some of our more casual listeners or people not closely acquainted with the Choral Arts Society might think, what? They're singing the Beatles? In fact, this fits very nicely into a lot of things that the Choral Arts Society has done over the years.
It does, but even so, I think even the audience who knows us really well is going to go, what? A Beatles perspective? This has been a bucket list concept for me for years. And over the last 6-7 years, we've been hitting the 50th anniversary of all these milestones of the Beatles. Their the first concert, the Ed Sullivan Show, the Shea Stadium concert, the Sgt. Pepper's. It came out to a huge 50th anniversary out. There was so much publicity around that. It just is absolutely time to do it. And this is the music I grew up with. Although I was very young, my youngest, really cool uncle was the one who kept saying, nah, put the monkeys away. This is what you need to be listening to. This is what's good. And, you know, the peculiar thing for me about the Beatles, my connection to them, which is I really feel is somewhat spiritual, they were my gateway to classical music. I mean, I heard my first, you know, major choruses and orchestra kind of orchestrations were my early Beatles albums when I was 8, 9, and 10 years old. And just beginning to steep myself as they grew into the studio and started doing bigger and bigger, more layered, more complex, more architecturally complex, more orchestrally complex, more sophisticated lyrics from, you know, She Loves You, Yeah, 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 to, you know, Because the Sky is Blue, it Turns Me On. This morph from the Bubblegum Band to a really sophisticated studio ensemble that was just bringing together some of the best musicians in London to produce, actually take rock and roll music on a complete left turn.
And, you know, as you described that, boy, you crystallized the difference between the Monkees and the Beatles. I mean, the one group, I mean, they did some entertaining things, of course, and of course, especially were aimed for youngsters like you and me.
Absolutely.
But, of course, the Beatles, and particularly by those later years, were doing incredibly innovative things, and they had this artistic richness that was really second to none. So.
There was a depth there that I think it was very shocking. I mean, McCartney began to and Lennon as well, began to really fall in love with some of the most contemporary music that was being done, Xenakis and Stockhausen and Schoenberg. They were listening to this stuff in concerts, and it was really affecting how they thought about music, asymmetrical phrases and just things you don't expect out of a glorified garage band. They just became more and more artistically entrenched.
Before we talk to Marvin and Mark, I want you to explain the title of the concert, which I think is The Long and Winding Road. You could have called this concert a lot of things. Why did you call it that?
For me, and maybe this is, again, part of my connection to the Beatles took me on a long and winding road from those early bubblegum songs to more classically oriented, even abstract kind of pieces like Revolution No. 9, as it was impacted by these contemporary composers. A real journey towards really liking rock music to really beginning to understand how the greater world of music worked and what could happen when you used instruments in different ways and bringing in Eastern instruments. And, you know, just like I said, the architecture of some of their songs, at a very young age, I was responding to that. Mm. And so this is just something this music's never left me. And every time I hear it in the radio, I just kind of go, yes, it's beautiful. Yeah. It hits a spot in me.
Right. It's amazing, isn't it? Music's capacity on a lot of levels, but its capacity to take us back to another time and place is a very visceral experience. Mark Paffrath, I would love to hear what you have to say about the Beatles, and in particular, what the Beatles have meant to you.
Well, how much time do we have?
Yeah, a little bit of time.
I guess in short, I mean, I, like Jim, was influenced really early on. I mean, I was probably about 8 years old, and my dad came home with a 45, and I'm sure he'd probably read about them and thought I'd be interested, and he said, here, I picked this up for you, and that was it. I mean, that was it from then till now. And I'm also probably one of those people of probably all of our generation where I've heard so many people say the same thing, that it probably, if it weren't for the Beatles, I might not be doing what I'm doing. I mean, I really do believe that. I mean, you know, I sat down and watched them on Ed Sullivan in 1964, and that was pretty much it, you know? Mm-hmm. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's really something to think about. Mark Paffrath not doing what he's doing. And so, I mean, it's like just perish the thought.
It is.
But I believe you, and I can, and certainly you're not alone in describing the Beatles as having that kind of direct impact on you.
As I said, many others, musicians of my generation, say that exact same thing. Mm-hmm. So,
Marvin Dykhouse, meeting you today for the very first time. Tell us about your own musical background, and then fold in the Beatles.
Well, I grew up here, and actually, I met Mark when I was about 15 or 16, and we actually started off playing Beatles songs back then in high school. And of course, I first record I had was Sgt. Pepper's, of course, and it was, you know, it was totally. It made art music accessible. Mm-hmm. It's like, what, you know, like when you listen to that, it's like, what is this? And it's like, wow, these guys, you know, this is something totally different. And it's not the Monkees. Mm-hmm. And although the Monkees have their place, but it made it really accessible to open your ideas and open your mind about how to listen to music and how to write music. Like, the, you know, when I think, when I go to write a song, I think of, you know, how would, you know, Paul or John write this song? You know, and I try to use that sensibility in writing.
They set the bar pretty high then.
They did, but that's really, you know, what a lot of people I try to strive for. But I echo everything both these guys say. It's they're an amazing band and super talented.
Well, and people also like me and Marv and Jim, I continue to notice that people our age and that are doing music and otherwise continue to be amazed to this day with the same songs we've been listening to for decades. And we hear them and we go, right. It's still unbelievable. There's something about it that is just, you know.
As well, I think the younger generations now are actually listening to the Beatles.
A lot of them are.
And it's like my wife was a music teacher and she taught Beatles music in schools for 30 years and it never got old. And the kids, you know, really latched on. I think that's a big part of, like, I think younger kids are listening to it again now, too.
That's a great observation. And I think, Mark, something I liked about the way you phrased that is it's not just, I mean, it's one thing that, I mean, like, you know, I might still like the song I Am Woman by Helen Reddy. That doesn't mean that I listen to it now and I'm finding new things in it to love.
Yeah. Right.
I just still like that song. But I think you're suggesting something even deeper than that, that one's appreciation for these songs deepens over time because there's more and more to appreciate.
Yeah. I mean, a song can come on and still today can still stop me in my tracks and just make me pause for a minute and just kind of go, yeah.
Well, that actually happened while we were working up this show. You know, we got deeper into these songs that, you know, we do a handful of songs. We don't do, you know, the Beatles repertoire or whatever. We don't do 20 songs.
We don't do all of these.
And so in, you know, looking at the songs and working the songs up, we're going, holy cow.
Right.
That's amazing. You know, we found so many things that are just, the harmonies are amazing. The lyrics are amazing. The chord structure is amazing. And we, you know, like I can see how they got there. You know, they used, actually, you know, they were, like, John was into, like pop music and stuff. And they used, a lot of their chord structures are, like, made from jazz. And it's like old tricks, but they made it sound so good in pop music, you know. Like, and it's just like, wow, that's amazing.
Last night when we were going over a song in rehearsal just before we were finished, and you said, to someone else in the band, you go, oh, well, no, it changes keys there. It goes out of that key, and then it goes back in. And I'm like, okay, I never even knew that. I never even noticed that.
Yeah,
you
know,
yeah, the seamlessness of it.
It just sounds good.
And they were well-versed in listening and figuring out that that's the oldest trick in the book. But it's great, you know, but it works.
It was almost never brought to rock and roll. That's the thing, they brought these things in. And, you know, really without the Beatles, I thought about this the other day, there would really probably be no Queen, no Moody Blues. I mean they said an entire industry in a completely different direction.
Well, they were the first. You're talking about how the Monkees, and I know about the Wrecking Crew, and basically all those groups out of Los Angeles in that time were all done with one band, with different frontmen. Well, the Beatles were until bands started playing their own music, like Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. And the reason they were is because of the Beatles.
Because they all
did their own thing, and that wave came over, and that changed music or pop music and rock and roll music forever. Mm-hmm. The Beatles did, I think, because of that.
We're speaking on the. Go ahead, Mark.
I was just going to say also until recently, something that both of you have talked about, Jim and Marv. I think as a kid, and even up until now, I didn't realize or think about all the music that they listened to before they got to where they were, the Beatles themselves.
They were voracious listeners, and Paul talks eloquently about how his greatest influence on his lyrics are people like Chaucer and Houseman, and that's not what you expect when you hear Mick Jagger interviewed about the Rolling Stones and how they put their music together. You know, his English literature prof at his prep school was one of the most influential people in his life in terms of broadening literature and how these smart lyrics come to be. And he's very self-effacing. So this is not poetry. These are lyrics to songs. And a poet who was interviewing said, I would beg to differ. And he read a couple of these back, and he said, this is great lyrics.
Mm-hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Jim Schatzman, Artistic Director of the Choral Arts Society of Southeastern Wisconsin, and with Mark Paffrath and Marvin Dykhouse, who are two guest musicians joining with the chorus in their concert this Saturday night called The Long and Winding Roads, in which the Choral Arts Society takes on some of the greatest songs of the Beatles. As I was afraid that we have nothing to talk about, so I'm just grappling here for, you know, how can we fill the dead air? No, this is just the opposite. I knew this would be fun. And Jim, could you just say a word about what is involved in getting the Choral Arts Society into this mode? Very different from what they typically do. And from kind of a musical and artistic point of view, what this concert represents for them?
It's a great question. There are two kind of competing challenges here. One is that this music is so iconic. People are going to come. Every song they're going to hear, they're going to go, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I remember that one. So we're going to have this kind of comparison to what's going on in their head and how this music they grew up with. So in terms of how you put the music together, you know, these 74 or 80 people who are presenting this music are not four people in a studio. And so you're going to get a very different approach. Some of our pieces are which lend themselves to very classical, kind of traditional approaches, are going to be presented that way. Others are going to be presented with a full-out rock band, putting pieces together as they would have been done in the studio in kind of a production sense. And even now, we're working, tweak each piece. We go, why don't we try that? Why don't we do this chord? Why don't we end it this way? Because some of their songs just fade.
I mean, even now, you're...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We will be producing these right to the end as we tweak things in. We had somebody do arrangements, choral arrangements for the rock band pieces. We bought a couple of pieces off the shelf. Marvin and Mark have been working for, 7 months? Yes. On working up this repertoire. As I said, some of these songs are not in their repertoire. They know them, but they've never played them. And they never played them as a rock band. And so, you know, we're putting a rock band together in a couple of weeks, as the Beatles would have done this, you know, for years and maturing in the studio. So there are some real technical challenges, but it's been a blast to go at it. I mean, just it's a mountaintop experience, even just to sit in the office and start sorting through and go, oh, this would be really cool. Let's try this. Mark, what do you think about this? Yeah, that's great. Let me talk to Marvin. Mm-hmm. It's been that kind of energy all year long.
Well, and I'm looking at the song list, and I can tell that you have this voracious love of the Beatles and didn't want to leave too much out. I'm not saying it looks like too long a concert. It looks like a real generous concert, but, I mean, it's not like you grappled to find songs to put onto this program.
Yeah. We had to grapple to figure out what not to include.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, yeah, that's the hard part, yeah.
They wrote just under 300 songs. Mm-hmm. And I said in conversations, I think of them more like Cole Porter or Irving Berlin than a rock band duo. I mean, they wrote hundreds of songs. Mm. And they're so diverse, from their early years to their late years to their studio stuff to their experimental stuff. I mean, it's just the diversity of the people are going to hear on this program is going to be stunning.
Right. So explain exactly what Mark and Marvin are going to be doing Saturday night, and also what role they have played leading up to Saturday night.
I think I'm going to let them talk about that. We had an idea to come together about this. Mark was the first person I reached out to, and then he said, oh, you've got to meet Marv. So we started talking more, but I'm going to hand it off to Mark here and then let him kind of bring Marvin into the conversation as well.
Yeah, and one of the things I'd like to say, just listening to you, Jim, is that one of the really neat things about this show is not just the diversity of the music, but the diversity of the arrangements. Mm-hmm. In other words, last mm-hmm. night at rehearsal, I sat back and listened to the chorus do a couple of songs by themselves, and just in these just beautiful, lush arrangements. And not only are the arrangements beautiful, but it was so fun to hear the chorus singing that material. Mm. It was, for me, it was really a cool thing.
And they sound great, by the way.
Yeah, they do. Fantastic.
Well, and I want to just interject here that that's no small feat, because you can also have a choir or you know, someone who's not a rock musician sing a rock song and not achieve that. One of the examples that comes to mind is watching a video of Pat Boone back in 1960 sing the song Turn Me Loose. And, you know, in his own very unadventurous, very conservative style, and I don't mean to cast aspersions.
That's putting it nicely.
Yeah. I mean, I don't mean to, and I'm not trying to cast aspersions on who he was as a singer or a person or whatever, but that he and that song were very poorly matched. And right. it was excruciating to watch and listen to because of that, because of the fact that singer and song were so ill matched in that case, and that this concert could very easily be that if you don't do it correctly. I mean, it can sound like a bunch of choral musicians who usually sing Mozart trying to sing the Beatles.
Some of the most embarrassing things you can see on the internet are choirs who are trying to do contemporary music. It's just horrible. I mean, they don't have the right approach. So we've cultivated a different sound out of the chorus.
Right. I totally applaud your vision and your sensibility and your to know how to portray that to the choir and say, okay, well, this is how this has to be. We can't do it like we usually do. We have to do it like this way. And you translate that very well. Mm-hmm. You're doing a great job. It's very cool.
Glad
it's
to hear.
Really
happening. And it works when you have a song like The Long and Winding Road, and we're up there playing it as a band, and they're behind us,
it's
doing the background vocals. I mean, I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it. It was really a neat experience.
Yeah. Cool. Well, when Mark asked me about it, I had seen, I think it's probably 2 years ago now, a concert. It was a Pops concert with Mark and two other gentlemen.
With Choral Arts.
And I was just like, I want to do that. I want to be able to do that someday. And then Mark asked me, and I said, yes, I want to do that.
Jumped at the chance.
Absolutely. It's one of those things that I have to do in my life. So this is it. It's great.
I know, gentlemen, that you have both brought your guitars. Do you feel like you would like to play a little something for us? Play and or sing a little something?
We could do that.
Okay.
It's a little early, but...
Okay. And while you grab your instruments, Jim, say a quick word about where this concert is and why this concert is there.
This is a venue that we've really grown to love. It is just very cool. We're going to be performing at the EAA Air Museum on 333 North Green Bay Road. It's been called the S.C. Johnson Taj Mahal to Experimental Air Museums. It's one of the gems in the state for pilots and aficionados of flight. It's just a big airplane hangar. And years ago, you may remember we did the Verdi Requiem. I was looking for a more industrial space, and I fell in love with this space. And the concert worked very well with orchestra and choir.
It really did.
It looked right. It sounded right. And so we've done several concerts in that venue moving forward, and all of them have worked. And so for this particular concert, we needed a big space because a rock band takes amount of space up there, especially when you add... And it's important to say we also have a string section. We also have a horn section. This is a full blown epic effort. And so when you hear these rock icons, these anthem icons, the Long and Winding Road, and Hey Jude, you're going to get the full effect.
It's all going to be there.
It's all going to be there.
Cool. Oh my gosh, really great. So what are you guys going to be doing for us here to finish out?
Let Mark sing one.
This is Mars Request. Is that because you don't have to sing?
Yes.
Fair enough.
Ready?
Yep. Misha, my bell, these are words that go together well. My Michelle, Michelle. Say the only words I know. Arabian old song. I need to make you see what you mean to me. Until I do, I'm hoping you will know what I mean. I love you. Get to you somehow. Until I do, I'm telling you so you understand. Michelle, ma belle, someday mon bon, très bien ensemble, I will say.
Imagine that with 70 singers behind it, floating out a wall of just lush, beautiful chords.
Incredible. So the song Michelle by John Lennon and Paul McCartney, one of a whole host of Beatles songs that will be performed this Saturday evening, 7 p.m., out on the grounds of the Racine Airport, Batten.
It's right next to Batten Field.
Right. Yeah. I mean, but that's how people kind of find it.
That's
there
right.
On North Green Bay Road.
I think it's 3333 North Green Bay Road.
It is.
I noticed.
And, Jim, if people want to have tickets, they probably should arrange them ahead of time, I'm thinking.
I'm recommending that people arrange for tickets ahead. You can arrange for them on our website. It is beyond the time to have them mailed to you, but they will be held at will call if you order them ahead. You can get them at Julie's Personal Touch Flowers, which is one of our outlets. And you can also get them by arranging by calling the Choral Arts office at 634-3250.
And the address for your website, do you happen to recall?
www.choralartsonline.org.
Choral Arts Online. Very good. Jim Schatzman is the Artistic Director of the Choral Arts Society of Southeastern Wisconsin, and two very talented gentlemen will be in the mix Saturday night as well, Mark Paffrath and Marvin Dykhouse, for this celebration of the great music of the Beatles. Thank you to all three of you for being part of the morning show.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
It makes me cry. Because the sky is blue.
You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And we're going to finish out today's morning show by going into the archives all the way back to 2004 and to one of the most exciting moments in my many years at WGTD, the moment when I got to interview Tony Barrow, the longtime manager of the Beatles and co-author of a book which was published back in 2004 called Paul McCartney, Now and Then. At this point in the interview, Tony Barrow is looking back at those exciting days when the Beatles first came to America and took the American public by storm.
Now, for me, at any rate, the greatest concert they ever gave, I don't mean greatest musically, because you do not get great music played on stage by any rock band, pop band, It can't be done. You have to have the technical perfection of a recording studio to do that. But the greatest experience, for me at any rate, was Shea Stadium in 1965, when the Beatles, they were new to these enormous outdoor venues, such as Shea Stadium, New York, and they had been used to playing in England in cinemas, where you could reach down, you know, and almost touch the kids in the front row. Cinemas that held perhaps maximum 3,000 people, where Shea Stadium had 55,000, 56,000. But the difference with Shea Stadium was that you certainly couldn't reach out and touch them. In fact, they were way across the other side of a baseball field. They were in the stands. And the remarkable thing about that performance, I think, and I'm very, very pleased that it was captured on film and exists today, the Beatles at Shea Stadium, is that the performance they gave was kind of thrice as large as life in their efforts to cut across this enormous gap and reach the audience or far away. So all their facial expressions, their hand gestures, everything else, were much larger than life. And when John raced his elbow down the piano keyboard from one end to the other, it was done as a mighty gesture so that it would be seen. And all of that, of course, comes over on close-up film brilliantly. This was the change in the Beatles of sort of them getting used to the huge venues that they would then play. That, at the same time, was then their downfall in terms of touring, because they couldn't give the performances that they wanted to give in such circumstances, makeshift stages shoved up in the middle of baseball parks. I mean, it's all very well, but it just didn't work. You couldn't give a superb performance in that situation. You were reliant upon the weakest link, which was very often the sound system that the local promoter had put in.
Mm. You talk about how still in 1965 they were mostly happy, but 66 things start to really go rather drastically wrong for them in a number of different ways. I, of course, have to ask you specifically about that unfortunate moment when John Lennon said his famous line about how they were more popular than Jesus. And that, of course, fell right into the heart of your own arena as their press agent to try to help them out of that public relations disaster.
Yes, that was at the very beginning of, or prior to the beginning of the final tour of America, the summer of 1966. And curiously enough, it was in Chicago, and I'm going to be in Chicago in a few days' time for the big Beatles fan convention, the festival for Beatles fans at the Hyatt Regency O'Hare. And I'm quite sure that I'm going to be able to tell the local story, my local story of how we got into Chicago all those years ago, with this hanging over John's head as to how could he possibly explain this. Because, I mean, in America, there were, particularly in the southern so-called Bible Belt states, there were zealots who were, in fact, organizing, probably for their own publicity as much as anything else, but organizing Beatle burnings, where they would burn in public bonfires of Beatle albums, etc., because of this terrible thing John had said. Well, in fact, John had made a perfectly relevant, adequate social comment in the context of what was a very good article in the London Evening Standard, to a very good journalist whom he was close to, and whom I still know today, Maureen Cleave, who had no intention of writing a sensational story at all. Nobody, no readers of the Evening Standard were upset by this remark at all, because they took it as being social comment. What John was saying originally to Maureen Cleave was, look, there are more people packing out the Odeon theatres that we play in than there are going to church to worship God, worship Christ. That's what he was saying. We are more popular. More people are filling the theatres to see us and other rock stars, he could have added, or are watching the television or whatever. I mean, what he was doing was making comment about the changes in the social order of the day, as it were. Now, it was only when it was splashed across the front page of a teeny bopper magazine in America called Datebook that it all got out of hand and misconstrued. And I must say that that one press conference which took place at the Astor Tower Hotel in Chicago, I don't even know whether that hotel exists anymore, but the world's press gathered in my hotel suite that night that the Beatles arrived in town. You know, it wasn't an all Beatles press conference at all. It was the Beatles, really, or John in particular, being called upon to justify himself, called upon to apologize for something that he had never intended to be blasphemous. And the, you know, I've never seen him so upset. I mean, he wasn't upset particularly about what he'd said, because he felt that he was justified in making the remark. But what was really upsetting John was the realization that because he had said that, and because it had been taken in such a wrong context, that he, John, might be responsible for the cancellation of the tour, because it was touch and go. That whole final American tour of 66 could have been cancelled if, in fact, the media hadn't been, shall we say, kind to John and carried his, what turned out to be a very stumbling, sometimes even incoherent, if you like, explanation of it all. He never did apologize, but he did try to explain himself, which is what, which we felt was the best that he could do. I mean, he kept sort of saying, I will apologize. If you want me to go out there and just say, I'm very sorry, I'll do that. And we said, no, John, do what you feel you should do, but explain. Take the time to explain. Well, the problem was that that was something John was never good at. He was very good at putting his thoughts into a song. He wasn't capable of giving a long, convincing speech, if you like, and that's what he was being called upon to do. It was a weak link in him.
Were you also trying to coach the other Beatles on what to say about this? I've never seen any of the others. I've seen footage of John Lennon trying to explain his comments, but I've never seen any of the other Beatles trying to explain what was said. At that first press conference, were all questions funneled back to John Lennon himself, or were the other Beatles also in an awkward position of having to somehow clarify what John was trying to say?
Well, the setup was the same. I mean, every city we went to throughout the touring years, we would hold a pretty large press conference, which was intended for local press and for the travelling entourage of media people, international media people, that we had travelling with us from magazines, newspaper groups, the Hearst newspapers, radio stations, etc. So we gathered everybody into one big press conference in every city. Now, the format, the setup was precisely the same as usual. The four Beatles sat down behind a table, and I stood beside them and kind of, you know, pointed out to the next guy, okay, you ask your question now, kind of a thing. There were fairly formal press conferences as far as we could make them so, but this one was entirely unique, never repeated and never experienced prior to, because, yes, it was a one-man press conference in the end. Everything was directed at. I mean, there was no point in the media asking George what he thought of this, or Paul, or Ringo. And it was, you know, it was John's baby, this. It was up to John to explain himself. It was John who had caused, albeit misunderstanding, he had caused problems, particularly in the southern states. Now, I mean, as I say, I do think that it was very largely people out to presenters or DJs or whatever, or the media of the day, out to gain publicity for itself. I mean, a radio station would go out and hold these Beatle bonfires, the anti-Beatles, down with the Beatles, let's burn their albums. All that stuff was, in fact, a publicity thing for themselves, much more than any real venom directed at the Beatles. But it worked for them, and it worked against the Beatles. And, I mean, there was a real fear. The tour went ahead because we did feel that the media had accepted what John had to say. The tour went ahead, but I do have to say that particularly when we got down to Memphis and places like that, that there was the fear in our minds that John Lennon might well be assassinated. And somebody at one of the gigs let off a firecracker, and I was standing at the side of the stage, and I remember I certainly turned around and looked directly at John on the stage there, and all the other three Beatles were also looking at him. And we really were sort of, you know, expecting that maybe he would go down.
Wow. That certainly helps us understand why the Beatles shut down the whole idea of touring and, in effect, retreated to the studio. And, of course, there did incredibly great and groundbreaking work until eventually the whole thing, of course, falls apart. As you look,
it was a sad thing, if you like, that the Beatles only had such a short lifespan as a working band, as a touring band, 3 years of national and international celebrity as a touring band. But I think we have to look at it this way, that perhaps if they had not come off the road in 66, maybe the world would never have had Sgt. Pepper.
Hmm. One of the things that is said in the book, I don't think by you, by somebody else in assessing what the Beatles accomplished and did, they talk about how in those last several years, in many respects, it was Paul McCartney who exerted, if anything, increasing influence and was increasingly important in keeping the band together and in making such extraordinary musical matters happen. That he was distracted of the four and the most focused on continuing to produce great music. What was it about his personal makeup that allowed him to play that kind of crucial role?
It was, if you like, a huge ego. I think any great performer, a great artist, a great creative talent of any sort in music or any other media of the arts or entertainment, I think there has to be a massive ego there for the whole thing to work. So he had then and still has today a huge ego. He was determined to succeed. I mean, he had said that he is the guy who at the very beginning of the whole shindig said to Brian Epstein, when Brian Epstein was signing the band, he said to Brian, if for any reason the Beatles doesn't work, I want to be a star. I'm going to be a star in my own right anyway, and you're going to make me one. Aren't you, Brian? kind of a thing. So it was largely that. I mean, he had in mind, you know, that his career was going to go on, whether the Beatles had stopped touring or not. And I do not look upon the breaking up of the Beatles in 1970 as a sad time at all. I do not look upon the women folk as any kind of wicked stepmothers, which history has sort of cast them in that light. I don't think the arrival on the scene of Yoko Ono with John or Linda Eastman with Paul, I don't think they sort of contributed vastly to the breakup at all. I think they contributed some irritation to a situation which was deteriorating in terms of the four of them. But I view the breaking up of the Beatles as being a very valuable thing in its own right, because the Beatles had come as far as they could come as the Fab Four. There was nothing more for the Fab Four to do contained within a foursome, within a quartet, within a group like that. Nothing really more that they felt they could achieve. But there were huge reservoirs of talent there, bursting to get out and go in different directions. And the direction that John Lennon wanted to go in was not the one that Paul wanted to go in at all. And it was far best that instead of struggling on, I mean, it had largely come in the final years, really, to most of the recording sessions towards the end there were solo recording sessions, if you like, to the extent that Paul would take a Paul song into the studio, and when he was ready to have some musical backing, he'd tell the others what it was about and brought them in to provide the backing for his song, as it were, and John would do the same, and when he got the chance, George would do that also. But they were no longer sort of cohesive foursome working together in total collaboration. They had already started to kind of artistically split away, and the fact that they finally did so, I think it's a shame that it was so acrimonious and that the lawyers came in and that it became a sort of, you know, like a terribly acrimonious divorce, if you're professional divorce. That's all a shame, but I think an awful lot of things were said, words of anger were said, and, you know, were taken back again either physically, in fact, or at least, retracted, if not said to be, they were retracted by the boys themselves. I mean, again, we're back to the brotherly thing. What I've said, the relationship of John and Paul was a brotherly one. Yeah, the brothers fell out for a while and called each other terrible names and, you know, punched each other in the face. But they were still brothers, and they came back to love each other later.
I want to ask you, speaking of relationships, what was your relationship to these four men through the course of your time working with them, in that you had to have been with them for so much time, obviously having this entirely professional relationship with them officially, but it's, I should think, not possible to be with people night and day, sometimes under very trying circumstances, sometimes in incredibly exciting and joyous circumstances. I can't imagine you not being very close to them in other ways, and yet I can't exactly imagine it being a normal friendship as we typically think of that. How would you try to characterize your relationship?
There was a very small what has been said by journalists over the years as being the inner circle. There was a very small and tight inner circle of business associates and aides around the Beatles. And this circle consisted, by and large, of totally trustworthy people. It may be partly just coincidence that most of us came from Liverpool, but that helped, I think. We all had the same kind of cultural roots. We all had the same kind of senses of humour, if you like, because there always has been a Liverpool sense of humour. There were these links from the very beginning. We were all kind of, when we were working, once we started working and living away from Liverpool and came to London and then came to the rest of the world, our roots were still in Liverpool, and we had that as a sort of link between us all. And I think that in itself counted for something. But I know what you're getting at here, and I think I can say that I deliberately avoided becoming completely the closest buddy pal and mate of either the Beatles or any of the other major international artists that I was involved with PR-wise after, because, I mean, I stayed in PR for another 10 years after that. I had my own PR company in the 70s. I only came out of PR when I was somewhat disgusted by the images being portrayed by the punk rock brigade towards the end of the 70s. That's when I returned to being a writer and a journalist. But until then, I was representing some of the largest acts in the world, in the music world, both British and American. I mean, I was handling the tours of Europe and the UK of people like Tony Bennett, Andy Williams, this kind of thing, alongside David Soul and Gladys Knight and the Pips and so on. It was a very interesting, very wide range. I kind of deliberately, and this sounds, I must be very careful, it sounds pompous, I don't want it to, I kind of kept at arm's distance. I kind of felt that I knew my place. I never wanted to mix business with pleasure to the extent of kind of making friends of artists unless they wanted to be friends with me. I always felt that there was the danger of any major artist, and particularly people as big and important internationally as the Beatles, I never wanted them to feel that I was a hanger-on, if you like, or that I was trying to gain any kind of prestige at their expense. And yes, I guess all of us in that little tight circle, to some extent, involuntarily bathed ourselves in the reflected glory as we stood in the wings there and watched it all happening. And that's all right, because that was a professional aspect of it. But I think I avoided the closer friendships that you're talking about. My friends were then, and all through the years have been, actually non-show business people, with a few exceptions. I have stayed in very close touch with one or two of the artists, two or three, a handful of the artists that I worked with in the 60s and 70s, but I honestly believe that I had a better relationship with the Beatles than if I had been too close to them. Hmm.
Tony Barrow, longtime manager of the Beatles, is the co-author of a book called Paul McCartney, Now and Then. His co-author, Robin Baxter, the publisher, Hal Leonard. I'm Gregory Berg. And that interview aired back in 2004. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, in his monthly visit to the program. With him will be Tracy Crocker, who is going to